Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource supported by our listeners. To find out how and learn more about the program, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We also thank the Management Learning Journal and the European Group for Organizational Studies for their wonderful support. Now on with the show.
Welcome to episode 92. This is a case study of the Manhattan Project and its illustrations of total institution and organizational secrecy. This is part one of the episode where we will provide the historical context through two videos. The first is The Day After Trinity, a documentary released in 1981, and the second being Los Alamos from Below, a lecture delivered by Richard Feynman, one of the physicists working on the project. To learn more, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com.
Hi, this is Greta calling in from Windsor.
And this is Tom calling from Carlisle, Pennsylvania in the United States.
And this is Pedro coming to you from Italy in a scorching summer day. I'm very happy that today, joining Greta, Tom, and I, we have Rohin Porpujari, which is a PhD candidate at London Business School and studies the Manhattan Project, among other topics, from an organizational perspective. And today will help us make sense organizationally of this very interesting case.
Thanks, Pedro. I, like Pedro just mentioned, I'm Rohin, calling in right now from London. And I've spent kind of the last 2 years steeped in the Manhattan Project and living with the protagonist. So I'm very much looking forward to this.
Yeah, thanks very much for joining us. And this is another one of our continuing series, or occasional series, where we're looking at historical case studies of an important organizational event. So we've done the Pullman strike last year with Jane Addams. We did the Hudson's Bay Company. And now we're looking at the Manhattan Project, which is probably one of the seminal events from the middle of the 20th century, because unquestionably the development and the use of the atomic bomb greatly changed the course of history. It did more than just end the Second World War. It set the stage for a whole different way in which nations and states interact with each other politically that led to the Cold War and has contributed to all sorts of challenges ever since the Cold War concluded in the 90s. The whole story about how the Manhattan Project came about and how it occurred is very interesting. It was a high priority project. It was the result of basically the perception of a race between the United States or the Allies and Nazi Germany to see who was going to create a weapon that could win the war on the favorable side. And this led to a lot of actions, like a streamlining of actions that one would not expect to see today in most circumstances. So with sort of that as why we want to cover this case, I'd like to turn it over to Rohin. And please tell us a little bit more in detail about what the case is about, and then we'll start examining it from an organizational perspective.
Yeah, perfect. So let me just give a quick overview of the case in a chronological sense. A bit of a precursor, which is 1939, roughly, was when not just World War II began, but also uranium fission was discovered and then replicated in the US, which led to this thinking around atomic bombs. And then there was roughly a two-year span, let's say 1940 and 41, when there was some movement around working towards a Manhattan Project, but the quote-unquote Manhattan Project hadn't fully begun. Famously, Einstein and Leo Szilard, another physicist, co-wrote and signed a letter that was sent to FDR, that is President Roosevelt, president of the US at the time, saying that we need to work on this and that Germany is most likely already working on something similar. This is when the more industrial apparatus, or let's say the military apparatus, came into action, and there was more committees being formed and discussions about how to go about this. And then it was 1942 when officially, so the name Manhattan Project comes from the name Manhattan District, which is when General Groves took over the administration of the project in the fall of 1942. And that's when things really scaled up. And that's when what we think of now as the Manhattan Project began, which is when they picked 2-3 huge sites to work on everything from uranium separation to plutonium production to actual bomb design. They hired all the people, they kind of co-located them, and the large-scale organization began around the fall of 1942 and continued until the summer of 45. So about 2.5 years, they were working on this full-time until the bombs were deployed. Quick point on the three sites. I think you'll hear these names quite often in our discussion, but there were three secret sites of the Manhattan Project. There were more than three, but three major sites. One was Los Alamos, which is perhaps the most famous name associated with the project in New Mexico, which is where most of the physicists were working on bomb design and doing more of the theoretical calculations and work behind bomb development. Then Oak Ridge in Tennessee, which handled uranium enrichment, so separating U-235 from U-238. And then finally, Hanford in Washington State, that worked on plutonium production. So those were three major sites that brought all this together. Yeah, I guess we'll discuss more, but what's really interesting just as an addendum to the timeline is that the project ended up having a huge legacy. It started off quite uncertain. The Danish physicist Niels Bohr famously said that, you know, it's not possible, you'd have to turn the whole United States into one big factory. In the end, that's kind of what they did and how they ended up achieving it, as Bohr later conceded as well. And now we can discuss this later, but now it's become so much a part of the imagination, the popular imagination or parlance, that we start saying things like, we need a Manhattan Project for X, for climate change, or for, you know, XYZ. And it's interesting to think about what do we mean when we say that from an organizational standpoint.
Okay, thanks. And there is a lot of media out there that covers the topic, from documentaries to popular films or Hollywood films. And for example, in 1989, there was Fat Man and Little Boy, which was not one of my favorite films, but it was made. It's supposed to detail the relationship between General Groves and Oppenheimer, who was the lead scientist in the project. But we opted to focus on two documentaries. One is The Day After Trinity. These are available on YouTube, but we'll have links on the page. The Day After Trinity is one documentary that basically chronicles the story of Oppenheimer and his involvement in the project, which basically was very transformative of him personally, talking about how he came into the project, what he did as a leadership, and how he felt about the project afterwards. The other documentary is called Los Alamos from Below. That's actually a filmed lecture. It's more of an audio lecture. It's they put pictures overlaid on top of it for video purposes, but it's a lecture by I believe it was Richard Feynman, who was one of the physicists at Los Alamos, who basically told his story of the bomb and the environment, the working environment, kind of from the inside. Both of the documentaries are about an hour to an hour and a half in length, and they're both, I found them to be very fascinating.
So let's start pulling the threads of what makes it so fascinating, both the documentaries and what they chronicle, right? Because I think there are a lot of topics that we can and we will think and talk about in the episode, from the way you motivate people, the way you coordinate the work of all these people, the way you are able to do all that while keeping a secret, and so on and so forth, right? So where should we start?
I just wanted to make a comment that perhaps it would be nice, Rohin, to tease into your part about the amount of money that went into it. Like you mentioned in your paper, like the $2 billion and 500,000 people, because that's the scale of the project that we're talking about, right?
Yeah, I mean, why don't we do that? And maybe that's a good segue to one of Pedro's point, which is the coordination of all of it. Yeah, it cost around $2 billion, which in present day terms is around $25 billion. And it was given, given that it was wartime, and that context, of course, is essential to understanding the organization of the project, there was already a priority system in place across the nation. And so this project was given top priority, which means that you then get first access to resources, to anything you need, to people. So for example, the military had set up this thing called the SED, the Special Engineer Detachment. And these were people from kind of high school, etc., who have some science and maths backgrounds. And people were quickly drafted into the SED and then placed at Los Alamos. And so it was a resource intensive top priority project. To give you a scale of what those $2 billion translated to, I guess I mentioned the three sites, but I didn't mention the size and what was involved. But Los Alamos was, in fact, one of the smaller sites. It covered about 20,000 acres, and they had about 10,000 workers working at the peak time. Oak Ridge, five times as big, covered over 50,000 acres, and then had 75,000 workers at peak time. And then Hanford was 500,000 acres, huge, and had 50,000 workers at peak time. When I say at peak time, it's because, of course, the estimates vary. And there were 500,000 workers cumulatively. But what cumulatively means is that you have a lot of people involved, for example, during setup to when you're actually constructing these plants, you're setting up the facilities, who then leave. They are subcontracted out. So speaking of subcontractors, DuPont ran the Hanford site, and plutonium production was kind of given under their care. And then there were many other subcontractors. A lot of the construction was a company called Stone and Webster, etc. So that 500,000 number comes also from all these subcontractors, where you've got people building just facilities. Because if you imagine having, you know, tens of thousands of people living in one site, then you have to build everything from dormitories to bathroom facilities to cafeterias, dining areas. They had recreational areas. They had their own kind of sports leagues and teams and you know, life. They were trying to kind of reconstruct some semblance of normal life in those sites, all of which required a lot of resources.
And it's worth mentioning that Los Alamos really was an isolated location. Still kind of is. I mean, it's a short drive nowadays from Santa Fe, which is a small city in the middle of New Mexico. But it truly was an isolated, remote location. There was nothing there. And it was chosen, I think wisely, perhaps, because it was so remote. This was such a high priority project, and secrecy was a big part of it. I mean, it had to be a secret project. So you wanted it somewhat remote. But that also meant that you had to build something for the, you know, and it wasn't just a matter of the life facilities. It was also building the necessary equipment or laboratories and whatever. This was very, very highly technical, highly complicated. Not the sort of thing that you can throw at a subcontractor and say, here's $1 million, go build a building. This was very deeply involved.
Just on the secrecy note, you'll hear me throwing in secrecy anecdotes throughout this episode, just because that's kind of where my dissertation interest comes in as well. And that was, when we talk about coordination, that's also a very important aspect that they had to keep in mind. So for example, Tom, you mentioned how the sites were remote, and that was very much an intentional choice, which made things harder. So for example, you still need access to, for example, a water source, etc. They would have preferred to be closer to cities with more resources, but they had to set it up in a more remote area. And then there were also a lot more micro interesting nuances. For example, John Dudley, who was one of the people involved in recruiting people from the Manhattan Project, because when they set it up in 42, 43, they had to go around the universities recruiting the relevant scientists. He couldn't tell them where Los Alamos was or what it was called or what the location was. And it was pointless for the scientists to ask him, because he himself did not know. He wasn't informed either. A lot of interesting challenges to getting work done under those kind of a context.
So I'm hearing all of this and trying to think of what we know about large-scale complex projects, from the pyramids to NASA to infrastructure, right? And there seems to be something about, first, all this money allows for you to build the organization that is at the base of such purpose, of such task, brand new, which is very challenging. But if you have the resources to do that, has the advantage that in a way that you can do that fit for purpose, so to speak, right? That you can consider what you need, which is in this case to be far away, but also to build according to what you need, that is, has furnished all the normal or semblance of normality that would expect to motivate people, right? But what is interesting here, and I think that's what we're hitting at, Rahin, is that the purpose for which all this is being built is a bit hidden, right? And that is usually an important aspect of pulling people together, is the extent they feel part of something, which they certainly do. But what is this thing is hazy, or deliberately kept hazy for reasons of secrecy, confidentiality, and so on.
Yeah, definitely. And I can't help drawing parallels with Alan Turing's work in Bletchley Park during the Second World War, which perhaps might not have had the same scale as the Manhattan Project, but the way it has been set up, the secrecy around it, and its impact on ending the war being of similar extent, I would say. And perhaps this also in terms of coordinating the work. You know, the computer wasn't invented yet. It was still offline technologies, you know, how they shared information and so forth. So perhaps that's also an interesting aspect to talk about. But a related thing I wanted to mention is, you know, in this podcast, we're talking about this case from an organizational perspective. But perhaps we can take a moment to stand still with the impact that this innovation has had, the lives it has taken in Japan. If you look at the current state of affairs, what the risk of this innovation means for geopolitics with the war ongoing in Russia. From an innovation standpoint, the development of the atomic bomb is phenomenal. It was a period of 6 years from initial discovery to deployment that this innovation took. Compare that to about a 30-year time frame of a similar innovation. It's phenomenal. But how it has been deployed, how quickly after they did the test, it was less than a month, I believe. Rowan, correct me if I'm wrong, without really understanding what consequences it had, how decisions were made where to drop the bomb, how human lives were treated in this experiment for the sake of ending the war. Definitely, it has done a lot of good because it ended the war together with, you know, the work that was happening in Europe. But it has also had, yeah, tremendous loss and grief that we shouldn't forget about.
So when you started saying that, I almost was tempted to say, well, why don't we park this? And, you know, because it's something that we certainly want to talk about in light of the new war that's happening in Europe and new discussions about nuclear weapons, which, by the way, when we scheduled this episode, you know, none of that was in place. But as you talked, actually what came to my mind was some discussion about the experience that the different scientists and, you know, workers that were in these different sites had, and the extent they thought or not about the implications of what they're doing, either because they fully understood it or not. But even those who understood that they were building a bomb, right, maybe did not fully grasp the implications. And, you know, and then there was all the discussion about, like, some people were opposed or not and so on. But what I'm trying to say with all of this is that I think there's something very specific about the way in which the work was organized and the extent in which people enjoyed, it seems, the experience of being in these sites. And that's where it comes from, the documentaries and the, you know, the materials we read, that for people, this was a unique opportunity because there was so much money, so you could do all sorts of new things, right? And you were working with people that was leading edge at all fields, right? Which usually in academia, you work in a very segmented way. But there, you know, the project brought together all sorts of disciplines, right? And the narratives that the people that work in such projects give in different interviews, including the documentaries we watched, is of all the fun they were having, the extreme that was unique, and the extent in which they were fully immersed into it. Which, now that you said all of that, made me think, maybe that's one of the reasons why they were unaware or willing unaware or just, you know, without thinking necessarily of the purpose for which this was eventually going to be used and all the implications, right? Because the task in itself seems to be so absorbing and inherently interesting.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. It might have been a strategic practice or strategy of them, like, by keeping the ultimate aim kind of secret, with people not really knowing what was being built and for what it was being used, that people were willing to invest in it because they did know they worked on something important that should end the war. I think, Rowan, you can tell much more about that than we do.
Yeah, I mean, just picking up on both your points, Greta and Pedro. Firstly, yes, there's a relationship between the organization of the Manhattan Project and what life was like there, and the fact that there was less time spent on implications and on thinking it through. So the idea, like you said, Greta, in less than a month after the successful test, there's definitely a link, and historians over time have also kind of come to see that as well. But that link can be thought of in two levels. One is the more organizational level, where in the Day After Trinity documentary that we watched, the physicist Freeman Dyson says the reason the bomb kind of was deployed ultimately was that the bureaucratic apparatus was already in place. And so it's almost like the momentum is in place. It's like then trying to turn around an 18-wheeler moving at high speed. You know, the Air Force had run their drills. They had it was called Operation Silver Plate. So they had their own kind of code name and stuff set up. They had designed the B-29 bombers to kind of accommodate each of the two kinds of bombs, all of which then lead to this idea of bureaucratic momentum, if I could use that phrase. I mean, I see Pedro's eyes lighting up every time I say the word bureaucratic. So we'll see what you think of it as well. But point is, so one level at which there's an interrelation is that level of the organization and kind of the bureaucratic structures giving momentum to seeing through what you've set up. You've invested all this money, you've put all these structures in place. And then the second level, which I think you were referring to as well, is the more individual level, which is when there's this intense sense of purpose. It's both intense and vague. So you don't know what the atomic bomb is. And a huge factor here is that it's a new to the world innovation. So you don't even have any analogies really or any reference point to guess what it could be. So it's vague, but it's also intense. You know you're contributing to the war effort. You know you're ultimately saving American lives, et cetera, or at least that's what you're told. It's almost like a risk of over-identifying with an objective that you don't stop to then think about what is this objective, what are the implications of this objective, etc.
What I'd also like to do then is kind of go back to the start of the project and sort of work our way forward from there, because it is almost impossible to separate the organizational from the political sphere in this. Because in the back of everybody's mind, first off, I think it would be interesting to find out or to discuss just what exactly was secret and what was effectively known or was common knowledge. Because on the one hand, the United States was trying to protect the effort as much as it could. But the fact is that a lot of people sort of figured out between the lines what was going on. They may not have known specific details, but the discovery of fission was pretty well known. So then it didn't take a whole lot for these very, very smart people to figure out what was this really going about? What would be they being recruited for? But then there was also the political aspect of the backgrounds of a lot of these scientists and intellectuals who were not necessarily what one would consider to be pure-blooded, patriotic Americans. Some of them had ties to the Communist Party, et cetera. And so there was not just a concern about protecting the project from discovery, but also protecting the project from those who the leaders of the project were really interested in recruiting, because they were the experts. They were the ones who were needed. Their expertise was needed in order for this project to come off in the first place, but they were a bit, you know, risky.
Yeah, and I think you can almost bucket it where there's different levels of secrecy and different levels of baseline knowledge among, let's say, the physicists, particularly the nuclear physicists, who, of course, will figure out what's going on regardless of kind of what's being kept from them. And most of the people, because most of the people working on this are, let's say, just maintaining a calutron, which is a electromagnetic separation device, or you're doing the wiring on something, or you're molding metal for certain tests or certain casings. There is different responses to secrecy based on that baseline knowledge. And then, although in 1939, like you said, Tom, fission was a widely publicized discovery, including speculations about chain reactions and explosive applications, by the time it came to kind of war R&D, there was so much going on that it was a noisy information environment. So let's say I was a chemist or a physicist, but not specifically working in that domain, I would have guessed that there's something going on, but I would not have known whether, you know, are they working on radar technology? Are they working on, even, for example, the Navy was working on nuclear power for submarine propulsion. So when there's a lot of alternatives to choose from in an information vacuum, in a way it was easier to protect the specific secrets of the Manhattan Project because people had more guesses that they could settle with.
So shall we talk a bit about coordination, bureaucracy, and the role of the army? The documentaries mostly focus on what happened in the Los Alamos part of this project and not so much about the other two sites. So there's coordination of activities within the Los Alamos site that we can talk about, but also how knowledge traveled, which people were like the integrators or the brokers between the different sites. How did they work together? Where they strategically split up certain parts of the project? Like it was the atomic enrichment, it was
Oak Ridge, and then was separate from Los Alamos, was separate from Hanford.
Exactly. But one party needs the outcome of the other party to do their work, right? So how did they do that when we were geographically separated? They probably had some phone lines to talk. They probably had some mail going back and forth. But how did they ensure, you know, how did they protect the boundaries to keep the information in, but also share the necessary information across sites?
Yeah, I suppose I could give an overview of what the compartmentalization setup was, and then I can talk about what actually happened. The compartmentalization setup was that there were barriers across sites. So technically, if you're a Los Alamos physicist, I mean, you know about the atomic bomb, but you're still not allowed to visit Oak Ridge and watch what methods they're using and how the plant is set up. Same goes for Hanford. So there's across site barriers. And when I say barriers, I mean both physical, literally a fence and a security guard, as well as communication barriers in terms of writing mail, etc. For example, there was mail censorship. I think Feynman talks about that a lot in his lecture. And there were within site barriers. So at Los Alamos, for example, it was again physically a fence within a fence structure where, based on the color of your ID badge, there was kind of red, blue, green, white. The white badged scientists had the access to get into that inner, the T area, technical area. And so you could be living on the campus, but still not have access to a lot of parts of the campus. Again, it helps when most of your documentation is physical, it's papers stored in file cabinets. And then those cabinets are placed in the technical area, which is guarded, etc. So there was within and between site barriers. You can think of it as the default was secrecy from the military's perspective. And there's a whole other interesting conversation about military versus scientific norms that were clashing during this collaboration. But the default was secrecy, and then sharing knowledge across these barriers was more on a kind of exceptional basis. So we also hear in the Feynman lecture about how they were working with Oak Ridge to try to solve a problem about uranium enrichment. And first they were sending letters to Oak Ridge through military mail sensors. They were not able to solve the problem because, like you said, some of this work, you need to be there on site to watch how it's happening. And so then they got special permission, Emilio Segre, one physicist, as well as Feynman, to go visit Oak Ridge. But at the same time, when they are visiting, they are constantly chaperoned by some member of the military personnel. There is always kind of surveillance. So this comes back to Tom's point as well, where there were also question marks around the allegiances, I guess, of some of the scientists. And so they would often surveil their own employees, so to speak. Yeah. So broadly speaking, there was compartmentalization, physical as well as communication related, within and across sites, usual kind of need to know access system where you have those colored badges, and overall culture of secrecy. So if you were, I think this is not there in either of the documentaries we looked at, but just to kind of add a bit of insight, if you were, let's say, a factory worker in Oak Ridge, anytime you're walking in and out of the factory, there's huge billboards outside with signs saying, what you see here, what you do here, when you leave here, let it stay here, or, you know, lose lips, sink ships, and so on and so forth. So there was a lot of that as well. Again, always important to keep in mind the difference between the responses to secrecy of the, let's say, the in-group, the physicists, and the rest of the workers, the majority of the workers, because the physicists were frustrated and trying to figure out ways to perforate these boundaries. But for a lot of the rest of the workers, there was kind of a willful blindness. As long as they're working for, they trust the government, they're working for the war effort, that's what they care about. B, there was an element of, fear might be a strong word, but an element of, I don't know what they're going to do to me if they find out that I've, you know, mistakenly taken a document out, I'm doing illegal things, you know, I want to follow the rules, which also helped protect. So there's both those hard elements of design as well as those soft elements of cultural secrecy.
So this is already a great masterclass on how organizations function, right? This interplay, which sometimes is not aligned and we have, you know, problems in structure and structure don't align and so on. But this seems to be a case in which this normative set of control was put on top of a strong structural set of controls, right? But I wanted to go back to what Tom was saying about the interplay of the organization and the politics, right? And some of what we said in terms of the organization of the work, their coordination, the where the sites were in place, in light of, I think, what the documentaries discuss, and is, I think, is a question that many people ask, is why eventually the bombs were dropped in Japan, right? You know, why was it necessary? Germany was already, you know, drawing and so on, right? It was a different scenario when that happened, right? When compared to when the whole thing started. And there's all sorts of justifications and rationalizations and pragmatic considerations. And there is this idea that, you know, things were in place. What that made me think is that not knowing fully the purpose of your work can be also stimulating, right? Because it makes you feel special. And in structural terms, if you construct an architecture in which from the size of the planes to the people that are overseeing the development of the war, to the people that are building the bomb, the interlinks are related to dropping the bomb somewhere, right? Then that's exactly what we're able to see, right? In a way, the compartmentalization seems also to have this effect of these different parts fully understanding and feeling that they are fulfilling their task in the moment that all gets coordinated, and the final coordination, so to speak, is exactly when you drop the bomb, right? And that was making me think, in the extent, in other organizations, the way we think of the goal for which we work and for the interplay of different parts that need to work together towards achieving something. And we know that organizations are basically about, you know, their machineries to allow for the joint effort of people to work together towards something. What is this something can have a big effect, right? Because in this case, it was the bomb exploding, but it could have been something different. It could have been preventing the war from escalating, whatever, right? And I was thinking that in relationship to all sorts of things, right? You know, what is the goal for which an university is in place and all the different departments work together, right? Is this to produce great students, right? Or is it to, I don't know, climb up the rankings? You know, we can think of many examples in which the extent in which you understand the interactions among the parts that make up an organization may have a downstream consequence in the way the task gets performed and the way people approach them.
I agree, Pedro. And it's really hard to imagine how the threat, the, you know, when we're talking about a situation where you have a real, no kidding, existential threat that is clear, present, is very different than most other organizational settings that we're talking about. Because I can imagine that given the variance and, you know, the not just the backgrounds, but the loyalties of all of the members of the organization, that the existential threat or the perception of an existential threat was so unifying, it allowed for a certain amount of willingness to forego one's own personal desires, never to let go of them completely, but to set them aside. Because it became very clear, and we'll get to this later, I'm sure, after the fact, when individuals realized what transpired, what they came to change their view about the project. But at the time, given that all you knew about what was going on in Nazi Germany was they were pursuing this, and so we needed to pursue this too, that has a bit of a dampening effect on individual desires and a bit, you know, it sort of gave a little bit more impetus for unity that I don't think is easy to replicate in ordinary organizational settings. I mean, a university undergoing its ordinary routine is just not going to be facing that kind of existential threat, except in the case where the finances become so dire that the university is under threat of closing, you know, which is an extreme, you know, situation.
No, I think that's a fantastic point. And I'm also thinking about, Rowan, you beautifully described like how they put all these boundaries in place to protect the knowledge from spreading where it shouldn't spread. But then at the same time, these sites were in very isolated locations in the US, they became villages to the extent of, if you compare like how many people were living there, there was a rich social life, cinemas were being built. I think the cinemas were ready earlier than the labs, if I remember some of the documentaries we watched correctly. So there was clear regulation on how knowledge should flow. But then there was also this social aspect, like there was a clear sense of a mission. There was a clear threat from the outside. You had people 24/7 in an isolated location, so there was hardly any life outside. And then you had the army that, very thinking about a temporary organization that came in, and you know, there were like several things. For instance, I think it was in the Richard Feynman lecture how they put all these rules in place about, you know, how women could not enter the meal barracks, and, you know, all these different examples, you know, how Feynman played with that in the beginning, putting, he didn't want to share the barrack with somebody else, so he put the gown of his wife on the bed. And so they also gamed the system a bit. But you see that as a temporary organization, they adopted practices from elsewhere. You know, the army was very present, and bringing these cultures of, you know, the engineers and the scientists together with the army, that perhaps has helped in very quickly setting up the rules of how things work here, I can imagine.
Yeah, I mean, and these things that we've just been talking about are all coexistent. They're not mutually exclusive. Where, let me abstract out a bit. So. Often where I see settings of secrecy, often there's a mix at the basic human level. There's a mix of fear and desire, both motivating people's actions. And so in this case, there is the existential threat. But like Pedro was saying, there's also that you get a sense of almost exceptionalism to be working on a top secret project, which is kind of what I also kind of explore in my work, which is the gray area where you know about a secret, but you don't know the secret. And so if you were a factory worker at Oak Ridge, for example, you're surrounded by all these code names. All the buildings are just kind of random letters and numbers. Anytime you enter, you have to show your pass, and then you are allowed in and other people are not allowed in to work in that building. So there's definitely both the kind of negative and positive drivers of motivation in that sense, and a sense of exceptionalism. I also wanted to pick up on what you were saying, Greta, which is, on top of all of this, there's that element of, it's both a temporary organization and a quote-unquote total institution, which is a phrase I'm only peripherally familiar with, so I don't actually know the literature. But it is one where your lives are on hold. So you've relocated. If you're a scientist, you've relocated from your university. You're no longer doing your basic research, etc. You're just doing this. Same goes for other workers, and many of the kind of more frontline, you know, carpenters, machinists, etc. Even are separated from their families, because only the scientists kind of had the privilege of all the family members moving with them. So that element of a total institution, where everything in your life, from your recreation to your socializing, to your meals, to your work, is in one setting and governed by one institution, it's more likely that you work relentlessly towards that purpose. That being said, I also wanted to circle back to Pedro's earlier point, which is, even with all of this, the articulation of the purpose, of course, has its consequences, where if the purpose was something more around just ending the war early rather than building a successful atomic bomb, perhaps it would have given rise to more thoughts from the top down. I'm going to quickly read out a quote from General Groves in his memoir, where he articulates the purpose. He says, "The basic American military requirements were twofold: to provide our armed forces with a weapon that would end the war, and to do it before our enemies could use it against us. So it's simply a purpose of build a bomb and build it faster than the Germans or let's say the Axis powers." And that's why you have, again, coming back to the ground experience of workers involved, once they conducted the Trinity test, the first reaction is not one of, for some of them, it was one of, oh, what have we done? But for most of them, like Tom mentioned, these were post facto thoughts and ruminations. The first instant reaction was just one of relief that it worked, or it wasn't a dud. Many of the scientists mentioned that it wasn't a dud reaction, even when they dropped the first bomb on Hiroshima. And that's because you're relentlessly problem-solving mode, with the problem already articulated as building a successful atomic bomb, that once you succeed, you just feel relief that you have solved the problem that you set out to solve.
It's interesting you brought total institutions, because I was thinking exactly that, because I agree with what Tom said, right? That in a way, all this was possible because it was temporary, and Nazi Germany is a very strong signifier, right? And it still is today, right? If you think of evil, you think of Nazi Germany, even today, right? To some extent. And I think so it's easier to bring people together under that idea, right? That there's a big purpose that you don't even need to know that you're doing the bomb, but you're doing something to help the war effort, because if you don't, the whole Western civilization, as we know it, is going to collapse, right? That is the kind of the idea. But the more we describe the way things worked, right? This merging of the engineering scientist culture of the military, the way the problem was articulated, the way this not fully understand your understanding part, but just not critically trying to understand the purpose for which we're doing something. If it was not for that purpose, I think we would describe this as a cult, right? Because as you said, you're totally immersed. You have lost your sense of flexibility to some extent. And you're always trying to just do more of whatever is in front of you, right? And one of our colleagues from the podcast, Samantha Ortiz, she writes about something very different, you know, about social movements and also on and so forth. It's kind of more like collective action type of issues. And sometimes, in some cases that she studies, we see the same thing, right? That sometimes people get so absorbed that they lose touch of the potentiality of critically reflecting of what they are involved in, right? And again, in her case, it's all things that we are, you know, prone to see positively, right? You know, like any kind of collective action to solve, you know, refugee crisis, or, I don't know, trying to build democracy into certain places. But again, it seems to be a very dangerous way to organize, right? Because if it is not for something that we necessarily on surface agree, you're basically just giving fuel to the idea that people should just do their job without any sense of for what they're working. And I wanted to say that because it's a bit provocative, but I see some parallels with the current idea of some sort of technological solutionism that we live by today, right? You know, all the debates about digitalization, AI, and sometimes I have the feeling that the people that are, you know, driving that, and the perception around people as well, is almost that it's inherently positive, so we just have to keep doing more of that because that's where science is going, that's where technology is, and that's the frontier, right? And in a way, by thinking in historical terms, I almost felt that we were able to glimpse at some origins of that discourse that is very, has become more pervasive, right? That of course we should do ABC and automatize everything and digitalize and bring algorithms in all sorts of spheres of life and work. Right. And I feel that sometimes some of those people involved into that, of course, not all of them, there's many people that are trying to bring reflexivity to that debate, right, seems to be operating that same way, right, in this kind of, you know, this detachment, only looking at the task and seeing that as the work to be solved, and that's inherently positive and should just do more of that.
I think in a way, this case is a good one to show how that whole move towards technologism is sort of originated. Think about what the reactions that I loved that part of the documentary, Rowan, and I had captured that too, about the feelings of relief and how they were talking about, well, you know, what would have happened? They were also going into this wondering, are we going to completely waste the entire state of New Mexico? What could possibly go wrong? But that didn't stop them from going ahead because of the task at hand. And I think that the enamorment, you know, because of the power of the weapon that was created, the power and what it did, how its use changed the course of history, I think it sort of set the stage for what would come afterwards as a general enamorment of technological approaches to solving problems, because we do not, probably still do not, really fully grasp how powerful technology can be. So then it seems to be an easy approach to solving problems, to take the technological approach, because not just the atomic bomb, but so many of the other technologies that followed, thinking about the space program, thinking about all of the other things that where the technology was at the centerpiece of accomplishing something really, really big. It's something that's very, very hard to hard to get rid of because it seems so simple and clean in a way apart from, say, the other phenomena that were happening at the time, which was a messy two-front war, where, you know, you did not know how that was going to end. The clean technological solution was quick and clean in a way.
So quick and clean that now we have enough atomic arsenal to destroy the world. I lost the count of times.
Yeah, and in that sense, it became a self-propelling thing, not just to the deployment of the bombs, but beyond, where then they moved on to working on fusion weapons and hydrogen bombs, which by then many of the scientists were disenchanted and kind of dropped out of it. But this military scientific collaboration continued. And not to say that this was the genesis of military scientific collaboration, that probably, you know, you can go back to people like Galileo and Da Vinci advising on how to build trebuchets or whatever. But it was probably the genesis of this, like, kind of the big science, the industrial scale military scientific collaboration. I think there was a bit of it in World War One as well. But it was after World War Two when we see it then kind of persist, regardless of being in a wartime context. And of course, Cold War led to a whole scenario of its own. But I just want to circle back also to that idea, Pedro, of how it is dangerous. And I said earlier in this episode about how one of the legacies of the Manhattan Project is this parlance we have of, we need a Manhattan Project for X, Y, Z. There's a great blog post by this nuclear historian named Alex Wellerstein. And he says, we need to stop saying that. We need to stop saying we need a Manhattan Project for X or Y because of just the factors that you articulated, which is sometimes it becomes kind of technologism with blinders on.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. And if so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch via Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you for the conclusion of this episode here on Talking About Organizations.